Tyler's Long One on RadioLeMans.com.
Hello there, this is John Hindorf, and for this Tyler's Long One, I'm the man asking the questions. Graham Tyler can't be with us, and our subject today is Matt Griffin. Now, Matt's been described to me as the best GT driver that nobody's ever heard of, so we thought we'd better sit down with him, as he's a near neighbour of me in Northamptonshire, and find out how he's got to where he is now, on the cusp of a really massive breakthrough with Ferrari. He's one of their favourite sons, but clearly that hasn't happened overnight. So Matt, first of all, welcome to our long interview, pioneered by Graham Tyler. We call it Tyler's Long One for obvious reasons. And let's start at the very beginning. Where did your motor racing career begin in terms of, obviously you're from Ireland to start with. Was it over there, or was it when you came to the mainland?
No, it was probably, my dad would say, unfortunately, when he bought me a go-kart when I was 10 years of age, and we used to head off in a van at weekends, and I used to race, you know, my go-kart in Ireland, all over Ireland. And pretty soon the kind of, you know, the infection of competitiveness took hold of both of us, so we started to do more and more. And then, you know, like 90% of the guys that you speak to, we started in go-karting, so race in Ireland. Then, you know, when I was younger, still living in Ireland, we came over, raced British Championship, European World Championship go-karts, and that's where I cut my teeth, you know.
Who were you racing against in the British Championship? Throw some names at me, in the Worlds as well.
Oh, you know, there's loads. Heikki Kovalainen, you know, Mike Conway, who's still a good friend of mine. You know, Jarno Trulli was there, even though he was in, you know, a couple of years ahead of me. There's almost too many names to remember, really, but you know, you name them, I probably raced against them at some point.
So when did you decide, and was there a particular time when you thought to yourself, not just dreamy notions of becoming a racing driver, when did you decide, and when did your family decide that there might be a career for you in this, and how did you go about it?
It's a strange thing, actually, John, because it's something that, you know, it happened over a long period of time, and before we knew it, it just kind of happened organically. As I was competitive, winning races in the British Championship, being competitive in the European and World Go-Kart Championships, it's almost like a natural progression to try to go into racing cars. So, you know, we did it, and it was my first step was the 2000 Winter Series in British Formula Renault. So it was straight to Formula Renault. And I do remember the very first test I had. You know, unlike the other guys, maybe we were a bit naive, but I didn't do days and months of testing, and then, you know, you apparently have your very first day in a racing car and you're quick. My first day in a racing car was a Formula Renault at SNET in 2000. I remember I was so nervous signing on. I wrote the wrong address on the thing, and, you know, I'm driving down the back straight at 150 miles an hour, and my head's wiggling, and I'm thinking, what am I doing? But that was my first kind of step into it, was the Formula Renault.
And you went on to do that Winter Series that year. Who were you racing with that year? Which team were you racing with?
Yeah, it was with Manor Motorsport that year, and it was the year after Raikkonen had just won the championship and was being propelled to Formula One. So obviously there's that excitement, and I think if you'd asked me, and I think if you ask every kid at that age, you know, we all had realistic ambitions, not ambitions, but almost like we thought we were going to get to F1. Yeah. You know, you find out the kind of realities of life along the way. But
how old would you have been then?
I was just 18 then. I think 17 going on 18.
So your first car racing was Formula Renault. You didn't do any Formula Ford or any non-slicks and wings?
No, not straight to slicks and wings. In hindsight, whether that, I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. It's very much the way that, you know, they kind of tell you, particularly when you're racing European go-karts, where it's better to get into something with grip. So we just kind of follow the lead of what a lot of guys were doing at the time. But, you know, I have to say, I did 2 years of Formula Renault. The first year, which was good, really good, you know, had some pole positions and stuff like that. Didn't win a race, but, you know, I finished, I think, fifth in the championship, and had a good battle with Heikki Kovalainen, who's still a good friend of mine now, who finished fourth. And then stayed in Formula Renault the next year, and I had a little fella called Lewis Hamilton come join the team, so his teammates with Lewis for the year, and that changed the dynamic a little bit. And for, you know, for a host of different reasons, I did struggle a little bit that season, more mentally than anything else. I think, you know, the speed was there, but just more mentally.
Clearly at that stage, your family's still a big part of funding your motor racing. How was it then, that was all you knew, how was it then being in a team with Lewis who didn't have to worry about money? What was the difference between one side of the garage to the other? Not in talent, not in what the team were giving you, but just mental attitude about not having to worry about the cash side of things.
I think there was definitely a difference, 100%. But, you know, I think, you know, with Lewis, and I've seen it firsthand, there was still, while he didn't have to worry about money, there was other pressures on him that he had to deliver results. And, you know, that's people say he had a very easy ride up through it. And fair enough, McLaren were paying for it and stuff like that. But it wasn't, they weren't paying for it regardless. He had to deliver. And I saw those pressures. But from my point of view, I felt that that he was definitely getting a lot more attention within the team. And it was actually that year, there was myself, there was Lewis, there was Pat Long and Ernesto Viso were the four drivers. And the kind of hierarchy sorted itself out quickly, whereas Lewis was a little bit ahead of both myself and Pat. And I think, you know, while Pat was at Manor, I was a little bit ahead of him. And halfway through the season, he kind of stopped racing with Manor and went to Fortec. And, you know, up to that point, I think I had out-qualified Pat, who's still a really good friend of mine now, at most of the races. And then he went to Fortec and promptly qualified on pole and won the race. And that, mentally for me, was what hurt me. I couldn't, you know, I found it difficult to deal with, because I'm here, you know, breaking my back to finish in the top six. And, you know, most weekends, you know, not by much, would be a little bit quicker than Pat. And he changed teams and immediately wins a race.
And particularly when you've got a team like Manor, who are acknowledged as one of the best, if not the best, in, you know, you would say Manor and Fortec straight away. You know, those are the two, with no disrespect to any of the other teams, but particularly at that time, they were the two super teams, for want of a better word.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, I'm not taking anything away from Manor. I mean, they were a really good job, but I do think that this year their focus was primarily on Lewis.
What was it like having Lewis even then as a teammate? Famously, he's developed into a very interesting character who clearly has skills outside of the cockpit as well as in, which is part of a racing driver's armoury. Don't get me wrong, I'm not criticising him there. People think I don't think he's got any talent. I don't think that's the truth at all. I think he's got some talent. I don't think we know how much yet, and I think from my point of view, when he leaves McLaren and goes somewhere else, we might find out exactly how good he is. And he might be even better than we think he is. But what was he like having him as a teammate, even in those early years? Was he that driven? Was he that manipulative? And again, I mean that not in a bad way.
I mean, I never really saw any kind of manipulation by him towards the team. I think that happened, but it wasn't Lewis doing it. It was the whole McLaren and, you know, thing there, which kind of forced the team's hand a little bit. So, for example, if there was one floor there, and if two of us broke a floor, for example, Lewis would get it, and that was the way it was within the team. But, you know, I haven't spoke to Lewis for you know, a good few years now, since we, you know, we kept in touch a few years after that. But I have to say that, you know, he was a nice guy, and I look at him now, and I don't think that's the real Lewis that comes across on television interviews, unless he's changed a lot, because he was a nice guy, you know, very driven, you know, had an awful lot of self-confidence, which is a good trait. And I think actually, you know, he's a few years younger than me, but at the time, so like he was maybe, I think, two or three years my junior when we were teammates. But actually, I think he was, be it because he'd been nurtured by McLaren, but he had actually more maturity at the time than me, looking back at it. Because I never struggled with speed, it was just the maturity, and that's where, me personally, I've grown a lot as a driver.
And in some respects, as you were saying, you know, that was your early steps into car racing, so I can understand what you're saying there. You two of the teammates there, Pat Long and Ernesto Viso, another two great characters. Pat Long, I think, possibly one of, if not the best American road racing driver, certainly of his generation. Ernesto Viso, well, he's gone on to do bigger, brighter and things, and he seems to have a career that's up and down like the Assyrian Empire. What were those two guys like? I mean, Pat, I know much better, and I find him to be a pretty nice and straight guy. Came up through Jeremy Shaw's Team USA scholarship, of course.
Pat's a great guy. You know, you could not meet a nicer guy than Pat. He's a fantastic driver, like you said, absolutely top line. You'd be, you know, hard pushed to find anyone quicker than him. But as well as that, he's a great, great guy. You know, just he's a really good friend of mine. We're really close. We spent a lot of time together, because as well as being teammates, you know, we hung about with each other almost every day in Northampton. So Pat's a really, really good guy. Ernesto, who actually I met Ernesto last year, was crazy then. He's crazy now. He's a really good guy, but absolutely crazy. I met him in Barcelona last year at the last round of GT Open. But, you know, Ernesto's a really, really good guy as well. You know, it's funny because as you move up through your motorsport ladder, you meet these guys, you know, be it racing against some of our teammates. And that year, 2002 in Formula Renault, when you look back on it now, was a really tough year because you had, you know, you had Danny Watts doing it, you had Jamie Green, you had myself, you had Pat Long, you had Lewis Hamilton, you had Will Davison, and Susie Stoddart was doing it. There's probably more there who are now professional racing drivers as well, I can't remember, but at least 10 to 12 people out of the, you know, I think it was a 40-car grid back then, have now made, you know, be it in Formula 1 or other things, fully professional careers out of it.
And as for yourself, you mentioned that camaraderie with Pat and one or two others. The centre of the UK, Northamptonshire, where not too far away from where we are now, what, we're 45 minutes away from Silverstone as we sit here. It's the real centre of what I tend to call the carbon fibre triangle in the middle of the UK. And as such, early 2000s, 01, 02, you would have been in with a group of like-minded and like-aged young drivers in their late teens or early 20s who were all living around the Milton Keynes, Silverstone, Toaster kind of area. What was that like, and who were your contemporaries at that time?
It was fantastic. We had a lot of fun, you know, because we were a bit more carefree back then, I guess. You know, we were racing, a little bit of partying maybe, and just having quite a lot of fun. I mean, you know, as I said, there was Pat, who was a contemporary man. I lived with two Irish guys, a guy Michael Keohane, who did well in Formula 3, and another friend of mine, James Murphy, both of which don't race anymore. But, you know, one of my best friends back then and still is Adam Carroll. There was, you know, Tim Mullen, a couple of Swedish guys who raced touring cars, Robin Rudholm and Richard Goranson, James Courtney. And we all used to, you know, different nationalities used to hang about together. And I have to say, it was really, really good, really good fun. Obviously, you get older and you know, the group kind of disbanded. But we still remain friends, you know.
The interesting part about that is you weren't all racing in the same series, obviously. Would you have had Danica Patrick around at that sort of time as well?
Yeah, Danica was there. I think she left in 2002. And so, you know, we used to be hang around with Danica as well. And there was, you know, there was a lot of other guys. You know, I remember one night where we had been out for, I think, a meal and a few drinks in Milton Keynes, and we're on our way home, and there's this guy driving an Audi quite quickly. It was Richard Goranson's car, an Audi, and I said to Rich, "Who's this guy driving the car?" And he said, "Oh, it's my friend Matthias Ekström." You know, and that's what it was like back then, because you know, no one was famous back then. We all had aspirations that we were all going to F1, and that was that.
All of us.
That was it. And you know, so you never know where it's going to go. So we really lived for the moment back then. And it was, I look back on it, and I'm sure I was Will, with really, really fond memories.
A big smile on the face of Matt Griffin, who is the subject of our Tyler's Long One here on RadioLeMond.com. I'm John Hindhoff. So there you were in the early part of the 2000s. You'd done Formula Renault for a couple of years. You'd clearly proved that the pace, despite that, was your first foray into car racing with Slicks and Wings as well. So what was the next step for you, and where effectively did you decide you were going to have to go? Because again, we're still talking about, and this is a point we have to keep making, at that point in most drivers' career, you're still on family and friends' money. So the next step up, presumably, is another big financial step as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's a lot of people don't understand it with motorsport, is that, you know, it does cost a lot of money, single-seaters particularly. So from my point of view, the next logical step was Formula 3. And it was, but, you know, cutting a long story short, we just couldn't really raise the budget for
that. How much would that have been in what? So that would have been 03, was it?
Yeah, that was 03. And we were looking at, you know, for an average team, £350,000,
for one season,
and that was like way beyond my dad's budget. I mean, you know, him and a few of his friends had helped fund my Formula Renault racing, and when I say, you know, I could say sponsors, but really they were his friends who just chucked in a few quid to help us out and used to come to the races. But the jump is so big and we couldn't really do it. We looked at...
What was Renault then, even with somebody like Manor? Was that about 150 or something like that?
No, well, it was a bit less, about 120.
Right.
But, you know, it's still a hell of a lot of money, you know. You buy a nice house for it.
Yeah, but if you've got 10 people, it's 12 grand in the season, and that's a lot easier to justify than going to people and asking for 30, 40, 50 grand, isn't it?
No, exactly. So from my point of view, we couldn't really do it, and I wasn't really sure where my career was going at the time.
Was the disappointment there, Matt? Was the frustration? Because clearly you'd proven yourself against the best people who were around then, because Formula Renault, as you say, was so strong at that moment, and in some respects was almost a better proving ground than British Formula 3, which was going through a little bit of a decline at that time as Formula Renault came up. So was the frustration, was the disappointment?
You know, looking back on it, not really, for whatever reason, because I was like, okay, I was quite pragmatic about the whole thing. If the money's not there, the money's not there. And I got involved with a guy called Nigel Rees, who had put some sponsorship with me. And you might remember Nigel, was a little bit involved in trying to get this Caparo One Make thing off the ground. Well, Nigel's actually a very, very good guy. And he took over, in a kind of unofficial way, a little bit of management from my point of view.
And had you had representation before then, Matt?
No, just me and my dad, really. So he kind of, you know, took over that and opened my eyes, really, to the GT side of things. Because as a single-seater driver, you know...
So you're 20-year-old or whatever it is, and GTs are for old fat blokes like me.
Exactly. And, you know, GTs are easy. Anyone can win in GTs. The truth isn't quite like that, but he opened my eyes a little bit, and he had put some sponsorship with Morgan Motorcars for Le Mans, and had suggested to them to put me in the car, and this would have been for the 2003 Le Mans 24 Hour. So in a kind of roundabout way, we did a deal that I'd do the 24 Hours of Le Mans and British GT. We had to bring a minuscule budget because he had provided sponsorship there anyway, through his company at the time. And so we kind of did that, and I was like, okay, I'm going to Le Mans. Didn't have a clue about the potential of what Le Mans was, really. I'm going to some...
Don't tell me you were another racing driver who went, well, it's only got 10 corners, how hard can it be?
It was more the kind of thing, oh, I've got to drive all night, God, you know. But it's... we went there, and... It was quite strange because, you know, I went to Morgan, we did the press releases, and then entry list came out for Le Mans, and guess who's not on it? Morgan. So left me high and dry, and, you know, he asked me a second ago, where was I disappointed when I couldn't get, when the F3 thing didn't happen? And I don't think, not really, because as a youngster, I suppose, I had a kind of unbridled belief that everything would be okay anyway. And I remember I was sitting in Adam Carroll's house, we were having a cup of tea or playing the PlayStation or whatever we were doing, and Charles Morgan rung me to deliver the news. And if I got a call like that now, it would disintegrate me, you know. Mm-hmm. But back then, it was almost like water off a duck's back. And luckily at the time, Nigel, you know, had been looking at other alternatives anyway. And Kenny Chen from Group M had come in to sponsor Tech 9 in the British GT, what was Cup Championship, which was the Class B. And we organised a test, and the test worked. And again, I was able to go there with, you know, Kenny and Group M footing most of the bill.
And that was in a Porsche, which is, again, for somebody who had... And forgive me for saying this, relatively little racing car experience. You'd done a lot of karting and you'd been successful in it. You'd done a couple of seasons of Formula Renault, Slicks and Wings. You then go into GTs with Morgan and then get into possibly one of the quirkiest cars to drive that's ever been built. And for people, you know, who raise their eyebrows when I say that, there, and I keep saying this, there are a lot of very, very good drivers who never get their heads around Porsche 911, but you jumped into that car and you were immediately competitive.
Yeah, you know, I remember the first time I drove it, I got out and they said, what's it like? It feels like a marshmallow, you know, because it was so soft and everything like that. But it really, I think GTs really suited my style of driving. You know, for whatever reason, maybe driving fast on the kind of back roads in Ireland or whatever, my car control's always been fairly good. And you really need that in a Porsche.
That's the rally driver in you.
Must be that, yeah, the Irish. So, you know, my car control is really good and I was able to always pedal the car quite quickly. You know, and to be fair, like, it wasn't the most competitive year in British GT you know, because it was the Class B, I think there was like 10 cars, but we, every race we finished, we won, and ended up winning the championship, which was brilliant, you know, for me it was brilliant. And then I had a few kind of choices to make at the end of that year, which kind of, in the end, I think, you know, it's difficult when you're that young and, you know, you need to decide what you were going to do.
Because you're still, what, 21 at that point?
Yeah, I was just 21 at that point. And, you know, at the end of the year, Kenny had said to us that he was going to buy a GT2, an RSR Porsche, and wanted to run in the British GT Championship. And, you know, again, I wanted to get to a point where I could race professionally. At the time, I was also instructing to earn a living at Silverstone and various places, and I wanted to get myself into a position where I could get paid. And at the same time, this Vauxhall Monaro project, which this team were bringing over from Australia, was coming about. And
now that I'm going to be slightly diplomatic and say, great looking car, great sounding car. The words ill advised come to mind. It never really fulfilled what people expected of it, that particular project.
Yeah, and you know, I was one of the people who never fulfilled what I expected of it, to be honest. You know,
was this a paid gig though, Matt?
Yeah, that was a paid gig. I had a 3-year contract. And, you know, I had a situation where, again, I had to bring a little bit of a budget, but something which we could have found easily for the British GT with Group M and a Porsche. Or I had a 3-year contract from Vauxhall, getting paid, a company car, Vauxhall Monaro, you know, all of the perks that goes with that. And honestly, with me, with a one eye on V8 supercars for the future.
Absolutely.
You know,
because this was the thing that people forget about this was backed by Vauxhall in the UK. It was the start of VXR, effectively, long before it was in touring cars.
Yeah, no, it was fully backed by Vauxhall. You know, we used to go to Luton to pick up our cars that we'd have as company cars, and I went down there in many meetings. You know, good sponsorship with Valvoline and Cummins, and the whole thing looked good on paper. Aaron Slight was my teammate, but it just didn't happen. You know, it didn't. Whether, you know, the budgets weren't there, you know, I'm not sure where the money went, but it didn't go in the place where it should have went, I think.
It's a big heavy car, and big heavy cars require a different style of driving, but they also require a certain amount of development to make them less heavy, for one thing, and make them drive more like a racing car. Now, when you've got 40 of them and they're all roughly the same driving around, it's a fantastic spectacle. But clearly, to me, and I remember back to that time, I'm a big fan of big V8s. Who isn't? What's not to like? But even at the start of that, my enthusiasm was tempered by the fact I just couldn't see that car competing against a, you know, a factory built Porsche.
Yeah, and it can't, you know, because it's not built for that. And to be honest with you, you know, initially the development moved forward and then it just stopped. And then for a couple of years, you know, I think that we had a lot of changes in personnel and the whole thing just didn't happen. And like you said, you know, we were competing as a 360 GT2s run by Scuderia Koss in the Group M Porsche, the Panos run by LNT, and it just wasn't the car for the job.
You had the right name for it though, Matt Griffin with Vauxhall.
Exactly. I thought that might help with the marketing side of things. But you know, I spent 3 years on that, more because my contract said I had to than I really wanted to.
Did you feel it was time that you were wasting, that you were treading water? I mean, you were getting paid for it, so you know, ka-ching in that point of view.
Yeah, but the cost was quite high, John, to be honest, because I was wasting time. You know, at that point in my career, you've got to be, you know, when I finished with Group M and Tech 9, I went to the Porsche Awards in Vysac and, you know, got a watch with my name on it and saying British GT champion, which I wouldn't sell for 50,000. And I had aspirations at the time to become a factory Porsche driver. I did. I really did. You know, whether they were realistic or not, that's what I wanted to be. That's where I could see my career going, or where I wanted to see it going, at least. And while I was messing around with this Vauxhall thing, doing British GT and breaking down all the time, not getting results and getting forgotten, it was what was happening. So yes, I was getting paid for it, but I wasn't getting paid enough, because I had to also, you know, I didn't get paid what I should have got paid, which meant I had to supplement it by instructing, and it almost got to the point where the instructing got more important than the racing, because I wasn't enjoying the racing, and I was my reputation from having, you know, first year in British GT being kind of people saying, oh, this Matt Griffin guy's not bad, to being Matt Griffin is who?
Yeah, exactly. Now, we talked about frustrations and disappointments before. Now, was that frustrating and disappointing?
That was massively frustrating. Like, really, really. And I got hugely disillusioned with motorsport and racing, to be honest with you, because
this was your first paid gig as well, so it must have, I mean, I think of you as a, you know, in your early 20s, 21, 22, 23 year old, and in, on one hand you're thinking, great, I've got a paid gig with a major manufacturer with somewhere to go, and then it's like taking the toy away or the puppy away from the kid, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, when I agreed the contract and I got my keys to Vauxhall Menor road car, which is like a 400 horsepower road car, give a 21-year-old kid, it's dangerous, but, you know, the traction control never stayed on, I'll put it that way. And
the tyre bill was more than the fuel bill.
Luckily enough, I didn't have to worry about the tyre because we changed cars every 3 months, so the cars would go back with not much tyres. But, you know, I thought, this is it. I've made it. You know, I really did think that. So, and when it didn't happen, and I felt I was inexperienced in the ways of the motorsport world, I suppose. So I didn't...
Well, the ways of the world generally, actually. Yeah. You're still a young lad at that point.
Yeah, definitely. And I think from that point of view, I could have done things differently even when I was involved in it, got out of it. I had other options that I was looking at that I couldn't do because I was linked into this contract.
Looking back at it now, and even as you're talking to me now, it's clearly you're finding it not difficult to talk about, but I can see some frustration and even some anger in it, in your body language. Do you feel that put your career back? And if so, by a year, 2 years, 5 years?
It virtually destroyed my career, John, is the honest answer. I mean, I was lucky to come out of that still driving, to be honest, because you can't afford one bad year, really. You know, if you're someone like, you know, a top GT driver like, you know, I don't know, Stefan Ortelli, for example, who's, you know, time after time proven he's one of the top guys, you can have a bad season, you know. But at the start of the year, you can't have one, not to mind three. No. So from my point of view, it really, really set me back.
And none of it you're doing either. And that again, must have been tremendously difficult for you to process.
No, it was, but I was very naive, you know, and, you know, you might say, oh, I was very young and stuff like that, but I looked at it with rose-tinted glasses and I didn't look into the detail of it and look at, actually, okay, you know, is the car going to be competitive? Is the team good? I didn't even know, I signed a contract before I knew who my engineer was, for example. And there's lots of stories that I learned a lot of lessons in that 3 years, that's for sure.
You're listening to Tyler's Long One. I'm John Heindorf. Our guest is Matt Griffin, GT driver extraordinaire. So you came out of that not completely broken, but certainly bent up a bit. If we were talking about a car panel, it wasn't going to T-cut out. You know, your confidence had taken a bashing. And at that point, you did what a lot of motor racing drivers do, and you concentrated on making a living. And let's be honest, we've all still got to do that. You didn't want to go and get a proper job. None of us do who work in this sport. So you were, like many others of your age and talent and ability, trolling around the country doing all kinds of car launches, doing driver coaching, doing representing manufacturers, and just being around and being behind the world of cars, you know, with traction control turned off, doing fast laps for billies, as it would say, billy bunters for punters. And it was while doing that that you had a massive turning point in your life, and it came under tragic circumstances at Goodwood. What can you tell us? What are you prepared to tell us about that? And we've spoken about this before we turned the recorder on, but what do you remember about that? And give us some details about how that moved you on.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, you look back and, you know, as something that happened to me was a bad thing that happened in my life. You know, I was in a kind of comfortable point. Racing wasn't going that well and I was a bit peeved off with it. I was earning a good living instructing. And I was doing a lot of, you know, quite a lot of instructing, and I was at Goodwood, and I was instructing in a Ferrari 360 Challenge car, and, you know, I was in the passenger seat, obviously no dual controls or anything, and the driver went off the road, and, you know, as many of your listeners, and I guess you know, that Goodwood is, there's no real margin for error there, particularly driving a car that's going to do 150 miles an hour, which is what we were in. And we had a monumental crash. Unfortunately and tragically, the guy driving was killed. miraculously, I guess, I wasn't. And
I've seen the pictures, yeah. and you say miraculously, and it's a tragedy that the guy you were instructing was killed that day. But how the hell you got out of that, mate, I don't know.
No, either try, to be honest with you. I mean, you know...
Do you remember anything of what led up to it?
Not really. I don't know. I mean, I remember the day being there, and I remember being on the track at a point, and the next thing I remember is waking up and not knowing where I was and seeing an ambulance and wondering what had happened, because the whole front of the car was gone. If I could have walked, I would have opened my belts. Luckily, it was a racing car and I had a harness. I would have opened my belts and walked out through the front of the car. I shattered my left leg. And had a compound fracture, broke 9 ribs, punctured my lung, was knocked unconscious. So I had some fairly serious-ish injuries, but nothing life-threatening, which was really, really good.
It's just starting to drizzle here at Hindhoff Tower, so we're going to push this indoors and head into the kitchen with Matt Griffin, who's the subject of Tyler's Long One. Now, that, for anybody, would have been a massively difficult situation to deal with. The mere circumstances of what went on, there was all kinds of recriminations that went on afterwards that you then had to deal with as well. At that point, were you ready to walk away? Did you consider walking away? Did you think, well, actually, I'm not sure I want to do this anymore?
No, that's the strange thing. Never. Instructing, for sure. You know, I was in the hospital the next day and I was fairly beat up. And, you know, the gravity of what had just happened was starting to hit me. And I said to myself, I'm never going to sit in the passenger seat of a racing car again on a track. It's never, ever, never, ever going to do it. But at that same thought, I said to myself, I've got to get back in a racing car as quick as I can. So, from that point, I never once thought, I'm going to give up this motorsport stuff. If anything, it focused my mind a lot. You know, you look back on your life, and I mean, you know, the crash was, you know, as big a crash as you'll get. I mean, Richard Westbrook, who's a really, really good friend of mine, he was instructing on the same day, and unfortunately, he had the guy who died. His son was in the car with Westy, and the first thing Westy thought as he approached us, there had been a plane crash, because obviously it's a light air landing area as well. So, and then he realised what had happened, and he said to me, you know, it's incredible. So, to look back on it and survive it, I've went through some bad bits and stuff like that, because it's hard to, when something like that happens to you, it's hard to kind of process, hard for the brain to process it. But I never kind of thought, oh, why me? Why this? But what it did do is really, really focus my mind on what I wanted to do. And I was 100% that I was getting back in a racing car and as quick as possible.
Were you still a single man at that point?
No, Debbie, who's my fiance, in fact, we're getting married, I think it's seven weeks now until the handcuffs go on. It's taken me a while to get
there. What you do in your spare time has nothing to do with us.
It's taken me a while to get to the marriage. No, but she was there, and she was, when after the first, because I had many operations on my leg, like 4 or 5, after the first operation, which was immediate, she was there immediately to support me, which was a good thing, and then looked after me while I was convalescing at home.
What was her thought about you getting back into a racing car, and did she ever try to talk you out of it?
No, she didn't. I don't know what her thought is, actually. I've never asked her. No, but I do think she had the same sort of feeling as me that I shouldn't instruct, because the whole thing about it is that, instructing is a good thing, and many guys earn their living from it. It's fantastic. You know, not a lot of guys particularly enjoy it, is the thing. It's just something you've got to do if you want to race. You can't hold down a full-time job. Now, that's not saying that they enjoy it all, they don't enjoy it all the time, because sometimes you can get like a really good guy who wants to learn and listen to you. Other times you can get a guy who won't want to listen to you, and it can be hard. And at the end of the day, you're sitting in the passenger seat doing, 150 miles an hour potentially, with absolutely no control over anything. Any after effects, the only after effect that I have is that I'm not a great traveller now. You know, I'm more...
I bet you're a terrible passenger as well.
I'm the worst passenger in the world. I'll drive everywhere. I don't like to be in a passenger seat. And even on an airplane, any situation that I feel that there's someone else has got my faith in their my faith in someone else's hands, I don't really like. But on the racing side of things, it's a pivotal point in my career, but also in my life. And it really focused my brain away from, right, I'm not going to instruct, I want to race. I'm a racing driver, I want it, that's what I want to do. So as you look back on it, while it was, you know, it's a bad thing that happened to me, and, you know, the everything else around it was quite tragic, from my point of view, you know, it changed my life for the better, let's say.
It's good that you can bring some positives out of it. As we say, a tragedy, and let's not play that down at all. So how long were you out, and how did you then fulfill that idea that you had in your head straight away, is I've got to get back motor racing?
Well, I was still in the contract with that Vauxhall Monaro thing. So I managed to come back, I think, for the last race at Silverstone. And it was more a point I wanted to get back and drive and race again. And it was, so it was about 3 months out. But I was very lucky because I had had an excellent doctor in Northampton, a guy called Bill Ribbons, who actually worked on Schumacher's legs. And he's the orthopaedic consultant for the British Olympic team. And some really, really good physios there who work with the British and Irish Lions. Because I had one doctor who said he wanted to do a particular operation that would have put me out on my leg for 8 months. And then I said, well, went to saw Bill Ribbons, and he said, I'll have you walking in 3 weeks. And he did have me walking. And that was good, because that got me back in a racing car, you know, before the season ends. And then this kind of, you know, while I had the thought I want to race, I didn't really do anything about it. It was almost like I didn't make a decision. I want to race, and that's all I want to do, and I'm going to break down every door. After that day, I thought differently about life in general, let's say, and I was very much more focused. And the following year, I still continued to race with in that Monaro thing, because that was 2006, the last year of the contract. But in the meantime, I've been, you know, I came very, very close to a deal with Porsche Super Cup, which was a British team with sponsorship from, you know, a big British company. And it didn't happen, and it was due to be myself and Richard Westbrook in that. That didn't happen. He went off and did Super Cup. I continued to do the Monaro thing, because I thought, well, racing something is better than racing nothing. And I became coach for the driver coach, but not in car, for the Ferrari GB Challenge team, the European Challenge team. And that was the first kind of taste of Ferrari I got. But through that, I met Peter Bamford. And this is the kind of thing where it all begins to change.
Now, Peter is a fabulous character. People in the UK will know the name, and yes, it is one of those. He is one of those Bamfords. He's not short of a bob or two, but he's a great enthusiast for all types of motor racing, going right through the vintage stuff, right up to the contemporary stuff.
No, Peter's a really good guy, very, very passionate about motorsport, and very committed to it, and goes about it in a certain way. And what had happened was, Peter had been racing Ferrari Challenge. He wanted to do some British GT stuff, so he went to Robin Mortimer for Team RPM. And little thing about Robin, because obviously he passed away last year. Robin was like a second father to me, to be honest with you, and a great guy. And when I had, you know, I don't want to kind of, you know, down on all the instructors out there, because, you know, the guys who instruct are good, and I've got loads and loads of really good friends that instruct. And when I had my accident, a few of them got together. You know, one of the guys was Ed Pead, who's a good friend of mine, and put together you know, a few quid for me. Everyone chucked in a few quid because they knew I'd be out of work, and Ed gave me a list of the people who put the money in, and at the top of the list was a guy called Robin Mortimer. I didn't know who he was, and he put in more money than anyone else. So I went around and thanked everybody, and I said, look, why did you do it? And he goes, I saw what happened to you. I thought it was bad, and I just wanted to help. And I built a kind of relationship with Robin from that. Yeah. And when Peter asked him, you know, to do British GT, he said, well, you'll need a pro. And he said, who should I use? Well, you know, Matt, what about Matt? Yeah. And that was in 06. So he did the last couple of British GT races in a 996 Porsche Cup again. So I was reunited with the car that I finished with Group M, the same car type. And, you know, we did that, which was brilliant. And then we did the following season in a Porsche 997 Cup car in British GT with Team RPM, which was a great team. And obviously Robin is, you know, became like, I was very, very close to him. And Alex is one of my best friends now. I was actually overseeing him this morning. So
Robin, one of those characters that populate British motorsport, who we don't actually talk about enough. And there's a number of them. And everybody knows somebody like Robin. Robin is one of the best guys I've ever met. Yeah. Simple as. And yes, he's doing it as a business, but it's much more than that, isn't it?
Oh, Robin, 100%. I mean, you know, with Team RPM, like, you know, he gave me drive in the Silverstone 24 Hour. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, either chose to make less profit on the race or pay for it himself. Mm-hmm. Out of the goodness of his heart, he paid for me to do a Carrera Cup race. You know, he helped me tons of drivers. You know, Joe Osborne, he helped a lot. Bradley Ellis, you know. For no other reason than he wanted to help us young drivers. And, you know, when he passed away last year, it was, me personally, it was a huge loss. But I think to British motorsport, it was a huge, huge loss. He was a large in life character.
So you'd had your first experience then, Matt, of driving Ferraris. And did you realise then that was going to be such a trail then through the next few years of your life? Because we're talking, what, that's 5-6 years ago now. And from then on, really, you've become almost known as a Ferrari specialist.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I suppose, my love of Ferrari started to grow then, when I was working with the Challenge team. And then, you know, in 08, when I drove for AF Corsa particularly, I didn't really, you know, I've always loved Ferraris, particularly the old ones. I mean, my favourite car of all time is a 288 GTO, you know.
Keep saving.
Yeah, exactly. You can have your Zondas or, you know, Bugatti Veyrons. For me, it's a 288 GTO. And so I've always loved Ferrari, but I never realised the power of driving a racing car with a Cavallino on the steering wheel. And it's a big difference, you know. I suppose if you're interested, it's a big difference. But for me, it made a big difference. And I'm massively, massively, massively passionate about Ferrari. I mean, you know, you can take all of the things I've won and stuff like that, but my number one top experience in motorsport was the first day when I went to do some development for Ferrari at Fiorano. You know, it was like a childhood dream come through. I was going through the gates and I actually couldn't believe this was happening, just because of what it is. And for me, you know, I've kind of chose that because I said you're better to attach yourself to a mark and then get known for that. And then, you know, if someone has a Ferrari and they want to race, and, you know, they'll pick you. I had aspirations of it, but I wasn't sure that I'd actually get, you know, more involved with the factory and come on board and race with the factory supported teams and that.
Talking about being involved directly with Ferrari, I mean, I when we drove down to Imola for the ILMC recently, just driving past Modena, as you do, and seeing Modena on the sign, I was like, well, have we got time to just and, you know, Fiorano's not that far away. Shall we just... So I know what you mean by that, but you're still a professional, you've still got to do a job. So how do you temper that enthusiasm that you clearly have, and God bless you for that, by the way, never lose it, with the fact that, oh my God, I'm actually working for a manufacturer and I've got a job of work to do here?
I think, yeah, that's a good question, because you can't be like a fan, you know, like I am a fan, but you can't rock up to Fiorano and be taking pictures of the track and stuff, and you're not allowed anyway, but you have to act in a professional environment. But while I was speaking to...
Telling me there's not a sneaky iPhone snap of Fiorano on your telephone.
I swear to God, John, there's not. I was afraid to do it. When I rocked up at the gate the first day, you know, I drove up to the gate and the security man said to me, you know, name, and I said, Matt Griffin, a Pilota. He goes, yes. He goes, park out there. And I said, but is it far? And he goes, maybe 1 kilometer. And I was like, oh, I can drive, I've got my race kit. He goes, no, park out there. So I was a bit miffed, and I walked what was 1 kilometer in, you know, with the sun blazing down on top of me with a huge big race bag. And I realized why, is that obviously they, you know, they'd organize a Europe car rental car, but it was a Renault. But if it had been a Fiat or Alfa Romeo, I would have been allowed in. So they're like that there, and that's that's one of the things with Ferrari. So I was afraid, because I thought I'm not doing anything that could possibly mess this up. But, you know, they asked, you know, when I was speaking to Luigi Dindo, who's the technical director of Michelotto, who's a fantastic guy, very smart, brilliant to work with. You know, I was anxious to relay to him that while this is a job and I, you know, act in a professional way, I have a deep passion for Ferrari. and working, being here is almost like a lifelong dream. And I think that's very much appreciated. But at the same time, when I'm driving the car, I'm not thinking, wow, I'm at Fiorano. I'm doing the job, John. I'm driving the car as hard as I can and giving the best feedback I can.
Famously, Ferrari are sometimes quite difficult to work for. And what have your experiences been like? And you're not Italian. You understand a bit of Italian, although you don't speak that much of it at the moment, although I know you're learning. What's it been like as a, you know, an Irish lad who is taken into the inner sanctum of motor racing?
It's a bit surreal, to be honest, but the first day, a bit surreal and also a bit lonely. And I'll explain the second part in a second. But, you know, the first, I arrived at Fiorano, did some laps, and we went for lunch. And I'm in the back with Luigi, and we're talking. And he said to me, his first words were, "You should learn Italian. Blunt as you like, that's it." Because for him, obviously, it's easier to communicate with me in Italian. Mm-hmm. And I think to begin with, Luigi wasn't 100% sure about me, because maybe his thinking was, why do we need this guy here when we could have an Italian tons to choose from? But by the, you know, after a few days, you know, I think we forged a very, very good relationship, and he, you know, I believe I did a very good job, because the
development. Did they ask you back?
Yeah, they've asked me back.
Then you did a good job.
And the development of GT3 is something different to other stuff, because there's no point developing the car as quick as you can do it, because the FIA will hammer you anyway. Mm-hmm. So we were working on other things with the car, and they would tell me to go out and do a lap time, and we did a test at Paul Ricard, and he gave me a lap time of 9.3. He didn't want me to go quicker than this, and it was an endurance run, and I drove for like an hour and 10 minutes with my quickest time being 9.3 and my slowest being 9.6, and from that point, and that's where I believe I did a good job. But it's fantastic working with them. It really, really is. You know, as far as when I said it was, it's a bit lonely, because, you know, you go out to dinner or whatever of a night after a test, and no one speaks English. Well, they do, but they all speak Italian to one another. So you're kind of sat there with your pizza at the end of the table on your own. But, you know, it's part of it. And I guess it's another incentive to beef up my Italian lessons.
Testing, obviously, has been a very interesting part of that. But you mentioned AF Corsa. You've become one of their go-to guys. And let's be honest, they've got a reasonable set of drivers to pick from when you look at the guys that have worn their overalls recently. You must hope that is going to bear some fruit, and, you know, potentially you still haven't been to Le Mans, have you?
No, I've not been to Le Mans, and I haven't even been to spectate, because I won't go until I drive. If I don't drive, maybe when I hit 50 and I haven't the chance of getting a drive, then it's slim, I might go to watch. But, you know, I've not been to Le Mans. And, you know, I desperately want to go to Le Mans, obviously. For any driver, it's the pinnacle. But, you know, someone asked me at the beginning of the year, would you, you know, why you don't get to go to Le Mans? And I wouldn't trade the racing I'm doing this year for one race, or even for the Le Mans series and Le Mans, even for five races. Because, you know, at the end of the day, I like to race, and that's that. But with AF Corsa, from my point of view, I love racing with them. You know, it's like a family to me. And, you know, Amato Ferrari is not just my boss. He's now become my very, very, very good friend. And he's actually the reason that I've become more integrated with Ferrari in general, because he's the person who made the phone call and said, you need to use Matt Griffin. I'd like if you use Matt Griffin. And he's the person who's pushed me.
What's the connection, as much as you can tell me, about Amato Ferrari, AF Corsa? Because it's not a works team per se. It's not run out of the factory. They have their own. But they are seen as one of the people who get quote-unquote preferential treatment from Michelotto, which is, for those of you who don't know, is the motorsport arm, if you like, of Ferrari outside of Formula One.
You know, Ferrari don't have, like you say, factory teams as such. You know, I suppose AF Corsa would be perceived as the factory team. You know, maybe they get the odd part here and there that of development. You know, luckily for them, you know, with the GT3 thing, you know, I was the main GT3 driver. I drive for them. you know, you got Jimmy, Bruni, Tony Villander, Fissy Kellett, they drive, you know, they all drive for AF. So from that point, the relationship is a bit strange from the point of view. I don't even know what the relationship is. I don't think there is a, you know, there's no contract between Ferrari and AF Corsa. I think it boils down to AF Corsa do such a good job that that's what it is. And I think if, you know, I can guarantee it won't happen. I think if AF Corsa start doing a bad job, you know, you would see the drivers and stuff go to other teams.
And what about Martino Ferrari? Is there any link between the name?
No, it's just.
We should dispel that. I knew the answer to that, but
yeah, no, it's just a coincidence. And you know, you look at a team like AF Corsa, and the reason why a team is successful is largely down to Amato Ferrari, because he puts people in down the levels who are the best at what they do.
Now, again, don't give away, Phil, you've got to give away trade secrets, but there was a very interesting development at Le Mans this year with Peacom Racing being run by AF Corsa with a prototype car. A number of different people have told us that that car very nearly had a 458 engine in the back of it at the start of the year, but for various reasons, mostly because Michelotto and Ferrari were shelling out 458s in all kinds of different guises so quickly that they didn't have the capacity to support a P2 programme. But I look at that and I salivate. And you, as a much closer to AF Corsa, must look at that and, with still thoughts of single-seater racing in your head, I'm sure, must look at a prototype and think, this is a good time to be around these guys.
I think, yeah, for sure. I think any time you're around AF Corsa is a good time, to be honest. To be around there is good. But yeah, I mean, the prototype thing, I don't think at the moment there's any sort of prototype plans for the future.
From
Ferrari, you know. AF Corsa do it because you have the Lewis Perez Compank and Matthias Russo, who have driven with AF for a number of years, and he wanted to race prototype, basically, simple as that. Wanted to do with AF because he'd have, you know, he'd been lucky enough to work with them, or, you know, chose to work with them and saw the level of preparation, etc., that they produce, and asked Amato to run the prototype program. You know, whether AF had to get some permission from Ferrari, I don't know. I don't know how that worked to do it. But it is run largely separately, to be honest with you. And I think it was with the Luis Perez that he wanted to do it. And as far as he's concerned, AF were the best team, full stop.
Let's bring it back to you, Matt Griffin. You're clearly enjoying what you're doing. You're racing a lot. Keeps you away from your family a lot, which for any of us is the hardest part of it, because, yeah, we love going motor racing, but as you get older, your responsibilities and your mindset actually changes. But do you look back now and think, oh, if only this, that and the other, and you look at somebody like Lewis Hamilton and think, maybe that could have been me in Formula One?
The short answer is no. And it's not because I wouldn't have liked to have got to F1. I would have done. And I think, you know, if some things were different, maybe I could have got there. But I'll tell you a quick story. About 2 years ago, I was sat in Valencia, and it was February. And I was doing some testing with AF Corsa in the 430 GT2. It was 20-odd degrees outside, maybe a bit warmer. And I'm sat out the back with a Serrano ham baguette and a can of Coke. And I'm sitting on a chair, and my feet are up on tires. And, you know, I was chatting, you know, Westbrook had been there that day, and me and Westy had been talking. And for whatever reason, the day wasn't going so well. We were struggling with the setup on the car. And it wasn't a great day, testing-wise. And I'm sitting at the back, and I'm a bit frustrated. And I remember sitting there thinking, hold on a second. I'm here, I'm in Valencia. It's 20 degrees, it's probably -2 in England, with snow or rain or something. 20 degrees, the sun's shining. I'm driving a Ferrari around a racetrack and getting paid for it. And it's something that I remind myself daily, that, you know, I wake up and I think, geez, I'm lucky. You know, I'm lucky to be racing, you know. And I think the difference between guys that make it as a professional, and, you know, I don't know what the future holds. You know, it's not the most stable of jobs, a professional GT racer, particularly someone like me. You know, from the point of view, you know, I've got mega opportunities for next year and stuff like that, and everything looks fine. But the crux of it is, at this point in time, I'm unemployed for next year. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the same with every driver. But the difference between guys who can make it and earn a living, one of the biggest differences is your interest in the sport. And I'm a huge, huge motorsport fan. So, you know, to be able to do this and get paid for it is brilliant for me. You know, and I'll sit at home on a Tuesday evening and I'll watch, you know, V8 supercars on motors. I'll watch the American Le Mans series, or I'll watch the VW Cup 25-hour thing at Spa. You know, I'm an enthusiast in motorsport. I love cars, and I get to do what I do. And I hope that passion kind of comes through. And I love to go away racing. You know, it's difficult, you know, because I've got a young daughter who's 14 months now. So it's a little bit difficult being away from her. But at the same time, when I'm home, I spend quality time. So every Monday I spend with her regardless. You know, this afternoon I'll pick her up from the childminders. And if the rain stops, we'll go down the swings and stuff like that. So it's... You know, my perspective has changed from that point of view, is that now I'm probably less selfish, but as far as motor racing goes, absolutely love it.
Is there one thing that you would have done different? Do you have a regret, or do you look back now and say, if only, maybe things would have been easier? And I accept what you're saying about, you know, you're a professional GT driver. It's not a bad time to be a GT driver at the moment. Sports car racing is on one of its upswings again. But you could have been earning 3, 4, 10, 20 times the money in a single seater, correct?
Yeah, definitely. And the only regret I have, well, there's two slight regrets. One is that when I was racing single seaters Formula Renault, I didn't have the head on my shoulders that I have now. And a good example was, there was one particular race at Croft where I got qualified second or something, got a bad start, and I saw the leaders, two leaders were getting away, and I made a rash move down the inside of Rob Bell, actually, because Rob Bell was another guy racing that season, who's a really good friend of mine, and he's another one getting the handcuffs in a couple of weeks' time. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'll be at his wedding, and I made a rash move, Zach Croft, down the inside of Rob, and we touched, and I bent my suspension in the pits. They bent it back with their leg, and I went out and set fastest lap. Now, in the same situation now, I'd say, okay, the leaders are getting away, maybe I can only finish third in this race, but I'll finish third, rather than panic and crash, which was what it was like then. So if I would have liked to have been a little bit, you know, I suppose, thinking about it more rather than driving. And the other thing is, you know, going back to that Monaro thing, it would have been better to follow the Group M side of things, because 2 years later they were running the factory Porsche team and FIA GT.
And your very good mate Pat Long ended up becoming a factory Porsche driver, going a slightly different route. Exactly. In fairness, but and being involved with somebody like Porsche at that stage of your career couldn't have done you any harm.
No, exactly. So that's the only regret I have. But, you know, when I say regret, I don't wake up in the morning and think, damn, if I'd done this or that. I wake up in the morning, make myself a cup of coffee, and think to myself, I'm off to, you know, like Paul Ricard tomorrow, to race, you know, a Ferrari, and that's the way it is, you know. And so I definitely have no regrets, and I hope my career keeps going and maybe elevates one more step. That's what I'm hoping, and I've got some, you know, I'm confident it will.
Well, I said at the start of this, Tyler's Long One, that you were possibly the best GT driver that nobody knew. Let's hope we've put some of that to rights now, and let's hope that your results and your performances continue to bring it to people's attention. Matt Griffin, thanks very much for being the subject of this, Tyler's Long One.
Perfect, thanks.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemon.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.